Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here as in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
What's up, guys? What's up, guys? This is Talking With on Talking Tactics. I've got the homie Musa Okwaga here with me. How you doing, bro?
Very well, thanks. Very well, Daniel. How are you doing? You right?
I'm doing all right. So we start all of these interviews the same way. Who do you support?
Manchester United.
And which country or countries do you have loyalty to?
in these nationalist times, I'm a global citizen. I'm a global citizen.
So if a World Cup comes up, there's no country, or if an AFCON perhaps comes up, there's no country where you're like, I'd prefer they win.
Only for narrative, only for the sake of narrative. So, for example, obviously, I'm from the UK, I'm from England, but if England struggle in the tournament, if they go out, then I root for another country. I'll just root for whoever has the best narrative. So AFCON, I was rooting for Senegal just because I think they needed that win to seal their legacy. And it's going to be weird because at this World Cup, because I just don't like the idea that it's being hosted there for a variety of reasons, I think I'm rooting almost for individual players. So I'm rooting big time for Gabriel Jesus at Arsenal. So yeah, like it's complex. It's complex.
I feel like these conversations, because the people I've interviewed so far have been African, but also diasporic. There's been like Carl, obviously, Ghana, England, Tosin, Nigeria, Zita. Like there's a whole bunch of people who are split. Like I'm
But also you're choosing violence, so that's also the point. It's something else. You're not objective. You're choosing violence. But no, I respect it.
Those are the types of things that interest me, because I'm a person who's split. So I'm born in Canada. I live in the United States, and I can never support the United States in anything. In fact, I actively root against them. And I'm Ugandan. So there's that. If someone asks me,
this just got more interesting. Okay.
If someone asks me, who do I support? It's Uganda. But then there's like that.
It's bold. You're playing to your base here. You're pandering to the diaspora. And I respect it. No,
There must be pandering. Yeah.
So I get it.
Another build-up question that we always have here. Yeah. Where did you grow up?
Almost no one will have heard of the area. I grew up just outside London in a place called West Drayton. In fact, where are you from? What town are you from?
I was born in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Right.
I currently live in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Right. So you're familiar with towns that people don't necessarily know immediately beyond the borders of your country, right? So West Drayton is like, it's not a place people know. But I grew up there. I was born there, grew up there. Was in the UK till the age of 34, and now I live in Germany, where I've been for the last 8 years. So yeah,
cool. That was my next question. Where do you live now? So I always get those out the way. Berlin. It's an interesting move.
Yes, absolutely. The heart of Europe. Loving it.
You prefer Berlin to London, or does each have its own idiosyncratic?
Yeah, you know,
and both.
Yeah, at this point in my life, I prefer Berlin. I could not have handled Berlin, I say, in my early 20s, because Berlin is a city where you can get lost very fast. And I know you can get lost in London, yes, but like there is a certain, Berlin has a hedonistic streak, which if you're not on top of like your business, it can just like tow you under, which is for some people, that's a preferable thing. But I think building a career in my early 20s, I think Berlin would not have been a good place to do it. Whereas now that I live there and what I do is established, I can enjoy all of it while keeping it in perspective. So yeah, I love it. It's perfect.
And another foundational question, and this is the last of the ones. Mm. The extent to your playing career. So how far did you go, either in school, in college, university? How far did you go?
Solid amateur footballer. So played many, many games, 11 aside primarily. I was playing until 3.5 years ago with a really good team, actually, in Berlin, just playing as a kind of a striker that came on. I was like the fourth or fifth choice striker by the time I stopped. So I played as a striker, mostly. A couple of years I played defensive midfield, wildly enough, played all across the forward line at one point. And I was playing 11 aside football for about 30 years, really. And kind of like Sunday League, you know, those listening to this podcast, in UK in particular, so basically like Sunday League in Middlesex area, just outside London, in London itself, and also in Oxfordshire when I was up at uni. So yeah, like a good standard of Sunday League, I would say. But yeah, very much an amateur footballer.
Mm, okay, so what made you pick Manchester United of all clubs?
My mother was there at university. So she came from Uganda as a refugee in the mid-1970s, and she had a choice of medical schools. And her medical school ended up being the University of Manchester. So that was just her team. So from 1970, this is Tommy Doherty era, like 74, 75, I think it was Tommy Doherty at Manchester United. That's when she became a fan, and I kind of just inherited it from her.
Interesting. So a lot of the stories we've had, people either inherit a club from their father or pick a club against their father in spite. So I had one guy who his father was a Liverpool fan, so he decided United just because, I don't know, just to be aggro. So just, I haven't heard I've taken a club from my mother angle, but that's really interesting. So well, your mother is into football.
She is into football. To be fair to her, though, as well, I did have to kind of develop my own attachment. So that was the club that she talked about the most. But still, the game that really sold me on United was the 85 FA Cup final when they beat Everton 1-0. The Norman Whiteside goal. So that was kind of, she was already a fan, but I think what solidified it was like that experience, because United actually at that point were kind of, they were a cup team. They weren't really a league team. They played quite flashy football, but they never quite sustained a league campaign. Consistent. They were really good under Ron Atkinson for a few matches and maybe even one season. But generally speaking, they were like more of a cup side at that point. But yeah, the fun came later.
So another thing I've picked up from talking to people in England, London specifically, and since you're from around that area, maybe not specifically, but Manchester United fans from the South tend to have bigger beef with Arsenal fans than Liverpool fans. So I'm curious, who's the biggest rival for United for you?
Listen, my only competitor is myself. I float above the fray. I don't indulge. I don't. People try. They try come at me, but I'm like, listen. It sounds a bit weird, but I'm a bit like, with my football club, I'm a bit like a sprinter. I just care about my times, and if my times are low, then no one else matters. And I suppose with football, I love watching football being played well. And I go on the Arsenal podcast, the Arscast, with Andrew Mang, and we joke about this, but I often say, like, may the best team win. And he sometimes says, like, he doesn't share that sentiment because it's just like, we're going to beat you regardless. But I have always seen that approach to football. Like, if we get beaten, whether I'm playing, whether it's my team playing and the other team's better, I've never really had a problem with that. Which is maybe why I've not been more successful in my life. But yeah, that's actually genuinely how I see football.
You see, like, I'm petty. So, like, there's a part of me that I still, okay, I hate saying this, Chelsea, okay, that's the team that they say I support.
You support Chelsea?
I mean, Musa, don't swear at me, bro.
I'm not like, judging, because that's a chaotic, you're having a very chaotic time at the moment, Chelsea, very chaotic. But it's never dull, is it? Yeah, it's never dull at Chelsea.
It's never dull. Again, all these conversations. Whenever I tell people who I support, there's like a piece of me that's like, but you don't really, because of like, I didn't know who they were when I picked my team. So now that I know who they are and I have to look myself in the mirror, it's kind of like, I don't like what I see here, but I'm attached to Chelsea. But either way,
there's variety within the Chelsea fandom. Like, you know, you've also got the Chelsea fans who basically own the pitch. So they've stopped Abramovich making the changes he wanted to make because they believe in the stewardship of the club. So there's also the Chelsea fans who came because of the massive amount of African players they had. So there's that attachment. There's actually like a sense in which Chelsea at one point with Chelsea and Arsenal were the natural destination for a lot of African fans to go to just because they had so many African players at mm-hmm. one point, if that makes sense. So actually, and then people joke and they have banter. Look, here's the thing. Being petty is part of being a football fan. I'm not completely above pettiness. There are certain things, I won't always name names in this podcast, but there are certain individuals and certain clubs that make me laugh now and again, that I will share some DMs and be like, but like, listen, that's my petty is normally not public. It's normally not
public. Petty is not public.
Sometimes, yeah.
I mean, it's hard to avoid pettiness just in general. Yeah, but yeah, of course. So if we speed up the timeline a bit,
yeah.
At what point do you realize that the United of Ferguson's days are over? So like if we go 2013.
Great question.
When can you pinpoint that this isn't the same thing?
Wow, such a great question. Do you know, not that sounds like a bit cheesy, but yeah, that's such a great question. Do you know what? I think it was maybe, it happened very fast. It may even be, so it, obviously it began with the David Moyes tenure. Because when he got appointed, I was like, this is already like David Moyes tried so hard to reduce the aura of United, to talk the job down. The bids that he made for Leighton Baines and Marouane Fellaini, that first transfer window, I was like, wow, this club is not, the infrastructure is not what it was. But I think the real turning point for me was actually Louis van Gaal, because when Louis van Gaal's project didn't work, I was like, oh, it's not coming back. That, I think, was the first moment, you know, because United were actually really good until about February. They beat City 4-2 in the derby. They were brilliant. They beat Spurs. They were playing some incredible football. They beat Liverpool 2-1 at Anfield, one of the best performances at Anfield I've seen in years. Mata and Fellaini were outstanding. And I just thought, my goodness, like Van Gaal is coaching so well. But when that experiment failed, that's when I kind of have a feeling, you know what, actually, we're in for a few tough years. Mm. And the worst thing about the United tragedy is that it was all avoidable, right? It was all completely avoidable. Anyway, here we are. I think that Sir Alex Ferguson had a lot more leverage to stop the Glazers being owners. I think he had a lot more leverage. I think if he'd walked away, because he was such a guarantee, he was a cheat code basically, right? And if you want to come to a club and basically load them up with all that debt, you need a manager who's a cheat code. I don't know if the Glazers come in if Ferguson says, if you come in, I walk. I'm not sure that happens. Also, Ferguson fell out with those two Irish owners. People don't talk so much about that now, but in 2005, basically, the club was only sold, or they only wanted to sell up, because Ferguson fell out with two of the biggest shareholders of United, and they walked away because they just weren't going to win the PR war with him, because he sued them over a horse he had no rights to the proceeds of. Rock of Gibraltar, right. Like, Sir Alex Ferguson basically like...
Are you saying the history of your club is ruined because of a horse?
Yeah, a racehorse, basically. The ego, yeah. That's it, a racehorse. And people won't believe it, but the ego. And they just, you know, the owners walked and they were like, well, they sold up and that was it.
That's funny.
It's what it is actually. Do you know what? In the context of like classical history and like the fall of empires, it is actually hilarious.
Of course.
It's awful and it's hilarious. Oh, it's wow. Hilarious. Yeah.
So what in your opinion needs to happen for United to get back? Is it as simple as remove the Glazers?
Where do you get owners that can afford United that people are happy with? Well, that's a huge part of it. But yeah, mm-hmm. I think actually a huge part is, but then I think only after you remove the owners, you sell up, and then it's another 5 years. Let's say the owners sell up now. If you look at the level that City are at, that like Liverpool are at, it's 5 years from today that United are getting back to a level where they're consistently dangerous.
So 15 years at least before you win a league. That's nasty.
Well, unless you like appoint Conte, which they should have done. But then again, Conte might have just like walked out the moment he was appointed. unless you're Conte, he's basically like, I call Conte the football whisperer, because he has the ability to like charm elite football from anybody, even those who seem like they're past it. But yeah, unless you appoint Conte, it's basically like years in the wilderness.
To the Glazers' point, and I remember on the podcast with Carl yesterday, I was going to bring this up, but it slipped my mind. How do you go about eliminating the Glazers, not on some like deep level?
Oh my God, John Wick, like John Wick. I'm going to the high school.
Removing the Glazers from their position.
Mm.
Before the game, there were protests. And yeah. I saw the protests, and in the crowd, there were people with the new kit. And I'm like, that's odd. And then they're walking into the stadium, probably with the season ticket. I'm like, that's doubly odd. How do you remove the Glazers when even the people who want him out or them out are still tied to the club on like a financial level, which in my mind would be the primary way of removing them.
Because it's like being a Roman Catholic and wanting to get rid of the Pope. This is the thing you have to understand. Like, people's attachment is so deep to this. Football is their escapism. There's people whose entire week, entire month, entire year, their happiness revolves around their connection with their club. And that is not a thing that money can replace, or the absence of it. Even, you know, staying away from Old Trafford is physically painful for a lot of people, because they're thinking, look, yes, I know it's an awful owner, but it's my club. And how can an owner come between me and attending the club that I love, the stadium that I love, and, you know, seeing my mates every week? And, like, you know what I mean? It takes a lot of strength to pull yourself away from something that you've loved for so long, and also, honestly, has given you joy for so long. You know what I mean? Like, how do you pull yourself away from that? Now, I've got friends who've quietly quit supporting United, who have been lifelong United fans, just because they've been disillusioned with so much of the recent stuff around the club, not just the ownership, but other stuff off the field as well. And it's a hard thing to pull yourself away from, I would say. Very hard.
Going to football adds value to your life, or at least that's how it could be perceived. So telling someone don't go to United is literally telling them, well, I hate the word literally. It's like telling them, cut your arm off. Like, why would I do that? I can't do that. It's not something of which I'm physically capable.
Understanding the spiritual place that football occupies in people's lives.
Yes.
Which sounds ridiculous to a lot of people who aren't football fans, but it is a thing. It's a factor. It's there, you know?
It's just odd when you see Old Trafford filled to the brim. I feel like you're hustling backwards, but I am sympathetic to what football means to people on some deeper level.
You look at Newcastle. Newcastle's ownership, their new ownership, I've criticized at various points the new ownership for various reasons. And also, I can also acknowledge that after years and years of Mike Ashley, this is like receiving a liter of the freshest mountain water after hours of thirst. That's what it's like for some people. Like, they're just like, you know what? I know the owners are terrible. And also, don't make me think about it, because what we had before was so terrible on a personal level. And I don't like that is the outcome. I don't even like that necessary conclusion. At the same time, I understand it.
Yes.
I understand it.
So what were your first impressions of Erik ten Hag?
Very good, actually. Very good, but also he doesn't have the infrastructure, and this is the problem he's going to face now. There's a really, when you say first impressions, I would say first impressions, there was the pre-season, which, you know, United were impressive. Then there was the start of the Premier League season, which is a different impression. And I thought he came out very honest when he said that he was concerned by the confidence drop, or he noticed the confidence drop in his players. And that's not him throwing his players under the bus. I think that playing for Manchester United, for the most part, is an anxiety-inducing exercise. Because everyone knows, it sounds awful to say this, playing for United right now must be a bit like being a new superhero in the Marvel Phase 4, where you have to follow all of those great Marvel superheroes, right? You have to follow Tony Stark, and everyone's expecting the Marvel of like Infinity War and Endgame, but it's gone. It's not there anymore. You have to like build something new, a new legacy. And there's a lot of people playing for United now who are aware they're being compared to Keane, Scholes, Beckham, and they're just not in the class of those people. But you've got 70,000 fans waiting in the crowd expecting that level of excellence, and it's not going to come back, not for years. And the pressure is astonishing. Does that make sense? The pressure is astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
For me, Ten Hag, just to sort of quickly round off the point, Ten Hag, I suppose the problem there then is that, like, I think he is becoming aware of how that pressure weighs on his players. And to his credit, he's trying to help them play with freedom and help them make their own legacy.
You see, that's an interesting idea, that the institutional memory, we could say, of fans lasts a really long time.
Yep.
The memory of players is transitory, because generations last 5, 6, 7 years. So those players, do they really remember what Scholes is like? What Giggs was like?
Of course they do.
But fans for sure remember. Fans are there for 30, 40, 50, 60 years.
That's the reason you come to United. You come because that's been sold to you. Like, if United didn't have that legacy and that history, a lot fewer people would join it. And this is the problem United have, right? As time goes on and people start forgetting. You look at Newcastle right now. Newcastle, a very, very wealthy club, the wealthiest in the world right now because of the resources behind them, okay? But they cannot attract the caliber of player they want because they don't have the history, the brand, not yet. If United keep losing their brand, they're going to start losing players to Newcastle because those two clubs are going in opposite directions. They just are. They just are. And this is a reality United have to face.
Mm. So let's do word association. Do you like word association?
Well, I've got no choice, have I? Let's go for it.
And it's funny. Some of these things were written down beforehand. I didn't know what you were going to say, but, you know, I guessed. We're going to start with Glazers.
Chaos.
Cristiano. That's enough. Ferguson.
Legendary.
Rashford.
Despondent.
Beckham.
Elite. Underrated. Better. Underrated. Yeah. Underrated.
Have hope. I'm sorry, bro. Paul Pogba.
Oh my goodness. This is so complex. Paul Pogba. Underachieved.
I love the torture of word association, especially for people who know a lot of words. Cantona.
King.
Okay. So when was your first World Cup?
The first World Cup I was allowed to watch. Sorry, I'm still bitter about this. 1990. Because when it was World Cup 1986, I was not allowed to stay up late to watch the World Cup in Mexico.
Ooh.
I'm still bitter about it. So 1990 was the first World Cup that I watched. Astonishing in Italy. Not many goals per game, but lots of drama. Then I actually attended the 1994 World Cup. I went to two matches. I went to two games at the Cotton Bowl in Dallas, I think. Sweden, Saudi Arabia. Sweden won 3-1. And then I went to watch the World Cup quarterfinal. I know it's wild. World Cup quarterfinal, Brazil, Holland, 3-2. Mm. I know. Unbelievable game. Yeah. Both unbelievable games, actually.
I tend to find people's attraction to football is heavily correlated with the World Cup. So is that what first injected you with the bug, even before your mother?
No. I was obsessed. Look, the obsession with football. So I went to a school called Marish. Marish, a school in the Thames Valley, which is a kind of extended suburb of London. And Marish, we were obsessed with football. And we used to play with these footballs. They were actually handballs. So there's balls that bounce everywhere, like the Ruckinaw handballs. Mm-hmm. And we played with them because they were the most durable balls to play with on the hard concrete surface we played on. So we were obsessed. We'd play every lunchtime for a full hour, to the point where sometimes we'd skip lunch and we'd get home with our packed lunches not eaten because we'd played football all through lunch. So the obsession came, first of all, with playing. Yeah. I played for a really terrible team called Golden Eagles. Shout out to them. They were awful. Our coach, Steve, was a lovely man. And Golden Eagles, it was the B team. The under 10 B team comprised all the players who weren't good enough to play for other teams. So we lost one game 34-35-0 within an hour. And the ball only crossed the halfway line, I think, twice, like from kickoff. So yeah, we were terrible. We were absolutely terrible. But the love of football came from playing lots of games, losing lots of games, but just like always being around it. But yeah.
Hmm. So in prepping for this, I told Carl, like, I got to read at least one of the books that you've
written. Oh, no, you didn't have to do that. Didn't put yourself through that. Oh, God. Oh,
come on, bro. Like, they're actually really good. So, but there's...
Well, thanks for taking the time.
You are more than welcome. But in the end, it was all about love.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't read the last chapter.
Too real.
Because it's something I need to do and I plan to write about, like going back home.
Hmm.
So I can't read it. I want to read it and I will read it eventually, but I can't let your experience touch mine. Cause it hit, like if you went to Ghana or South Africa or hell, Rwanda, I'd have read it, but.
Yeah, of course. I understand.
Uganda, I can't.
Of course.
But, but in the first part of the book, you mentioned that your grandfather managed the national team of Uganda.
Yeah.
So what memories of that do you have, if any?
I don't have any memories of him doing that. So, okay, so his name was Julio Peter Abbey. So he was, you can actually find on Wikipedia, there's an entry. So he managed the Ghana national team before, back in the 60s, I think it was. And then he was also head of the Ugandan FA for a single year in either 1972 or 1973. And that was an era they were quite good in the end. They ended up going to the African Cup of Nations in the final of 1978 and losing to Ghana. Right. So they had a decent side, actually. What I remember from my granddad in terms of his football ability or the coaching, he came to football training once. And actually, this is at the time when me and my team were getting a bit better and getting quite good. So we invite him to training and, you know, he's playing against like 11-year-olds, right? And he's like, oh, like, does a granddad want to come over and take some penalties against us? And he's like, 5-a-side goals. And he was like, oh, yeah. So he kind of walks over and he always had this like impeccable, like snow white Adidas track. I don't know how granddads keep tracksuits that clean, like pristine white Adidas trainers, pristine like white tracksuit. Comes over and everyone's taking penalties and he stands up as our keeper. And our keeper is really quite good. He's the reason we didn't get thrashed by Moore. And I'll never forget, my granddad stands over the penalty spot in a 5-a-side. So he's basically standing like, what, 12 yards from goal. And I kid you not, he hits 3 penalties, absolutely perfect, with no backlift, using just his laces and his hips. Didn't move his shoulders at all. Like, just swiveled his hips and bang, 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 no backlift, nothing. And I remember thinking, this was like a 75-year-old man hitting the ball with the power. He hit the ball with the power I could not generate until I was about, I would say, maybe 15. Like, wow. He ripped it. Yeah, and I was like, oh, that's the first time I understood that technique in football is not just about muscle strength. It's about like all these other things. So yeah, that's the first time I watched and I was like, oh my God, like my granddad's actually a beast.
He's like a superhero. He showed you guys levels. So
the levels, was
this the same grandfather that you wrote about in One of Them that was doing the dictionary English language thing?
Yes. Yeah, same guy. He was also the headmaster of a high school in the north of Uganda, Gulu High School. So yeah, he was a headmaster, he was a coach, he was a teacher. Yeah, he did all of that. Yeah. He had a full life.
In the book, there was a bunch of questions I had, but like, did he ever finish the dictionary?
I don't know if he did. It still exists. Like, he wrote it all out. Mm-hmm. And different people have done dictionaries, but I think he might have done, actually. There's no reason why he wouldn't have done. But then again, you know how dictionaries are an ongoing process. I think he'd done the bulk of it. I think it's fair to say he made the bulk of it. But yeah.
I remember my dad was going to, I don't know, the YMCA, and he met, it's a weird thing how Africans detect other Africans, and they always meet. So I met this person from Southern Sudan or whatever it is, and this person printed out our language dictionary, and my dad gave it to me. So I'm Iteso. The person printed out the Iteso dictionary, gave it to my dad, and my dad gave it to me. I'm reading it, and I'm like, how do you go about doing this? Is it colonizers who wanted to make, like, who did this? And it must be, now that I think about it, someone like your grandfather who just sit down and just transcribed the dictionary.
Not just transcribed it, but codified it, because there was oral tradition until a couple of generations before my grandfather. Everything was oral. Well, for a lot of people, it was oral. So my grandfather was like, let me start codifying this and get this all down. So he was part of a generation of people who were like, we need to start writing this down. Also, don't forget, the north of Uganda was a place that was like, you know, they had to fight off colonizers. They had to fight off people from different borders, from the north, from the south, like all the rest of it. So there's an element of like trying to preserve culture before people come and wipe you out. Mm.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Now we transition a little bit from football. We'll come back. But yeah. What subjects did you study in university?
I did a law degree. at university, and then I qualified as a lawyer. And the thinking there was, I always wanted to be a writer, but in order to be a writer, I thought I need to have a fallback first. So I thought, what better than a law degree and a law qualification, just in case things don't work out, I can always go back into a corporate field.
So is that decision of leaving law, I get that sense from the writing. Is that something you're at always peace planned. With?
Oh, always. It was always the plan. Like, it was always the plan to leave being a lawyer at some point. I just thought that I would, you know, in my naive mind, I thought I would leave it to greater security. So I thought, you know, okay, look, I was maybe naive. I was thinking, let me qualify as a lawyer, do my law during the week and then write at the weekend, and then maybe put together a manuscript. And if I can sell a book, that will allow me some time to like move on to different career transition. But of course, when you work full time as a lawyer and then write at your weekends with commitment, you just don't have energy for both. Like, it's actually not possible spiritually to do both. For some people it is. Shout out to those who've managed that. But for me, I just couldn't do it. I just wanted to be a writer too much as my main thing. And so I had to leave.
What kind of lawyer were you? Corporate, legal, like what kind of law did you do?
I was, sorry, I'm only laughing because when I told my ex-girlfriend, who's still a dear friend, when I told her what I was doing at uni, she burst out laughing. I said I was a construction engineering lawyer, and she burst out laughing because she's like, that's so far from who you are or where you want to be. So yeah, that's why.
What is a construction? What kind of law is that? Is that like, you know,
just project management? So project managers, like stadium building, for example. So that a stadium is being built, you will draw up the contracts around who has to deliver what, when, who has to deliver the financing for the project, who has to certify that it's finished, all that stuff. So yeah, it's actually like, if it's work that you enjoy, it's really well paid and you get to travel really well and you get to enjoy like stuff being put up. You get to see the world being constructed and you get to say, oh, I was a part of that, which is like kind of cool actually.
But I could see why a person who really likes writing could easily leave that.
Because the lawyers don't use words with the same freedom that writers do. They just don't. Like, being a lawyer is all about using words with an exceptional precision, but not just an exceptional precision, with a prescribed meaning. Whereas so much of the fun of writing is the ambiguity or the kind of the way the language can be bent and shaped. And lawyers are not really, they're generally not here for that.
I did an English degree in university, and I feel like it was a good decision in some ways. Because you kind of just, you get to study. And ever recently, I'm learning the difference between reading and studying. There's a difference.
Yeah.
And having an English degree allowed me to study and learn how to write, how to construct arguments and this type of thing. But as you rightly deduced when you made your decision, there's not much to fall back on once you do that, unless you want to become a teacher, which is why I feel like, you know, we always hear, you know, doctor, lawyer, engineer, those types of things.
Do you know why that is? It's because if you do like a degree like English, when I look at my friends who did English degrees, I noticed something. I was like, these are all middle class white people doing these degrees, like for the most part. Let me just clarify that. The friends of mine who did English, history, and then went on to corporate careers, they were all like, oh, we'll do English, we'll do history, then we'll go and do something serious like banking later. But those people all came from the kinds of backgrounds where you would have some contacts that would help you out. Like, I remember thinking, as a black guy doing a history degree or an English degree, if I don't get into like one of, let's say, 20 top unis, then me doing an English degree in the job market as a black guy puts me way further down the pecking order. Whereas if I do a law degree at any one of 20 unis, a law degree from any one of 20, let's say 50 universities in the UK, is still a great degree in the job market.
Yeah.
Like, because the thing, the bias against people of color in the job market is well documented. Like, you have a foreign surname, you better have a surname, you better have a degree that like mitigates that. That sounds brutal, but that's been my reality, to the point where if I had not done a law degree, I'm pretty sure there's a lot of places that would not have rented me a room. I'm pretty sure when I turned up to rent from a lot of people, especially in London, the fact that I was a qualified lawyer made them go, yeah, this guy, he's going to be good for the money. As opposed to doing an English degree where they're like, oh, he's just wishy-washy, even though it's the same person, the same intellect. But having the law degree has kind of been a shield for me my entire life, to be honest. even long after leaving the law?
I was able to get away with it because my parents understood the limitations I had in other subjects. So like we want Daniel to go to college or university, I guess, for purposes of clarity here. So we want Daniel to go to university. Any subject is almost good enough, just as long as you do something. That's just something. My brother is the one, I think he's younger than me. He was the one that got all the more of the pressure because he was, I don't know, he's just great with numbers. So he did the engineering side of things. Yeah. For me, it was just like, just go to school, figure it out. So I was like, I'm pretty good with like talking, arguing, all that kind of stuff. So I'll just do English. But you're totally right about you need protection in some ways. Yeah. Or maybe you don't need it, but it's good to have.
Oh, you do need it. I think you, well, I haven't, well, I've got a Muslim first name and I'm a dark skinned black dude. Like you need some protection. You need some, you need something. You need something extra, I would say. So, yeah.
So I want to talk to you about the economics of writing. And I don't mean economics in a financial sense. I mean conciseness. When I read your books, a book and a half, book and two thirds, one and two thirds, your writing style is very concise and economic, I would say. And how do you, or how have you perfected your writing style? Because for me, it's really easy almost to just write or type everything that's in your head. Mm. But the science of whittling down sentences.
Mm. Two things have helped with that. First of all, Twitter's really helped because you have to express yourself concisely all the time, right?
Yeah.
With real precision, because if you're not precise, people come for you. And which we both know. And then also, like, people are busy. So if you want people to read something that you've written, you're competing with Netflix, Disney Plus, and other streaming services. You're competing with people's favorite music. You're competing with all these different media that didn't necessarily even exist when you were coming up as a writer. So in order to compete with those things when you're writing books, what are you going to do? You're going to write less and be precise because you've got less space to get your time across. Like, for someone is more likely to read, if I write a 500 page book and a 100 page book, people are more likely to pick up the 100 page book. They're more likely to take it on the train with them, put it in their back pocket, put it in their bag, whatever. And that's what I'm thinking. So I'm like, less is more, always less is more. So those two factors, they force, and also just like, just from reading and seeing what connects and seeing what's so shareable, my whole philosophy with writing has been keep it simple, but not basic, right? So simple to the point where it's clear, but not to the point where it loses all meaning and content.
How is the process of getting a book published then? Because I would assume that book publishers don't follow that idea of like 100 is better than 500. They want words like 60,000, 40,000, however much it is. And you bring them a book that's maybe 20 or 30. What is the struggle of trying to get people to understand, like, no, there is a market for this. This is where the attention spans are going.
It took a year. It took a year for, in the end, to get published. Because people are like, it's too short. It's too short. Oh, it needs to be 50,000 words. It needs to be 70. I'm like, no, it's been said in that time. So I have struggled to get stuff published that's been shorter.
Mm.
That was literally the key objection for a lot of people. Oh, it's too short. And I'm like, what? So that's what I've had to deal with. But then I'm like, well, those are the books I'm writing. So if you don't like them, then unfortunately you have to find someone else. But thank goodness Rough Trade Books showed faith in it, because everyone else literally was like, no, it's too short, or we're not sure what it is. Is it poetry? Is it prose? Is it memoir? And I was like, my goodness, like,
it's just a book.
This is when I found out that actually people were not that experimental. You get, oh, we're bold, we're path breaking. No, actually you're not. You're actually quite afraid to do something new. Because this book, actually, I'm not going to sound arrogant, but like, no one that's reviewed the book since it came out said it was too short. No one said that. So like, now that it's out there, people are like, oh, we're reading it. So where was this fear coming from? It was coming from some people in publishing.
So how do you manage the simplicity of writing? And when I mean the simplicity of writing, I mean, you're sitting there at a computer putting words together, and it's really easy to get distracted. at least for me, anyway. If I'm at the computer and I'm writing something, it's really easy just to go check Twitter and, oh, nah. Like, I don't know, 20 minutes have passed or 30 minutes have passed. How do you manage the almost the banality of it?
This is what works for me. It's not advice. It's just what works for me. So you can put stuff on your laptop, which blocks websites. So I think the Freedom app is pretty good. So it just stops like just absent-mindedly just browsing whenever you want to. So it basically like puts a, so it puts a delay of a few seconds on each site when you open up, which is quite good. The other thing that I do, the most practical sense, is I start writing really early in the morning when everything's fresh in my mind. So I don't second guess myself. I don't doubt myself. So I will think about what I'm going to write the night before. So for example, let's say I'm going to write an article tomorrow about climate or about which new player Juventus should buy. I will think about that the night before and I'll be like, I won't write it tonight. And tomorrow morning I'll wake up and first thing in the morning, I'll get like a black coffee and glass of tap water and just write for 2 hours.
Tap water?
Yeah, yeah, always hydrate. You've got to hydrate all the time, man. We got good tap water here.
No, I'm just like,
yeah, yeah, tap water.
Are you against bottled water because of what it does to the climate?
No, no, whatever's to hand, man. So, but yeah, we've got filter. Yeah, filter water. Yeah, filter water, whatever, bottled water. Not knocking. So yeah, we have a black coffee and a big bottle of glass of water and just write for 2 hours because that way my concentration is absolutely at level. Everything's distilled. And there's something about the way that my brain works is that if I think I'm going to write about Juventus the next day, my brain just kind of like mulls it over overnight. And then when I wake up in the morning, I'm ready to go.
That is so serendipitous because Carl and I yesterday when we were on the podcast, there's this thing like if you give yourself a math problem and you can't figure it out and you go to sleep, your brain works on the problem in the background. And then when you wake up, you can come up with solutions. So it's weird that you correlated that same thing with writing. And I never did it because I learned it in a math class. You're onto something.
That's how I wrote. That's exactly how I wrote. That's how I wrote those books so quick. That's how I wrote In the End, It Was All About Love. That's how I wrote one of them back to back, those books, because I had that process, same process, like waking up, alarm going off at 6:20, I'm at my desk, write till 8:20, might write till 9:30 maximum, then like take a break, write for another hour, and then like maybe another hour in the afternoon, then I'm done. 5 great hours done by 3 p.m.
Good.
Yeah, it's awesome.
That makes sense. Yeah. So you are also in the podcasting space. So I wonder... Yes. Are you more comfortable talking, maybe with your lawyer background, it might make sense, or writing? Like which is more your happy place? Like the written word or the spoken word?
For me, it's interchangeable.
Okay.
It's genuinely interchangeable. Yeah, I love both. I love both. Writing will probably always be the first love because it just where it made everything else possible. I love crafting something. And I think maybe actually now I think about it slightly more writing because podcasting is a relatively new career for me, only a few years, but writing's been a thing that like from day one, it's always been something I could see myself doing. So yeah, probably writing most of all, but closely followed by speaking now, I think closely followed. Yeah.
So football journalism in particular, I'm always curious about this, about just Black African people who get into this. And this is something I discovered with Carl almost. Is there's sometimes this inclination of the powers that be to relegate Black journalists to an extent. And then when something racial pops up, they'll call you and be like, hey, there's a spot on Talk Sport. There's a spot on Sky Sports. Can you please come talk Black for us and tell us how bad we are? And then you're relegated again to your space.
Can I say something? What's the language policy on this podcast?
I mean, you can say what you want.
Fuck those people.
Let's go. We're okay, part of that.
So what I'm saying is, okay, here's the thing. So we can't talk Champions League tactics or the flow of a game, all the fun stuff, all the stuff which doesn't get the backlash. They can talk about that. But when we want to do the fun stuff a lot of the time, it's changing now. The generation like below me, I would say, Carl, yourself, Mayo, Quadri, like, and there's always been good people in football that have helped me. And I want to mention specifically Philippe Auclair. Philippe Auclair was amazing at helping to bring me in and help me out. Sheridan Bird, who's now doing, I think, TV. He's doing Italian TV for Juventus, actually. Andy Brassel. These people have always been huge supporters of my work. They've helped me at so many points. Like, you know, so Philippe brought me into the Football Writers Association. And he was just someone was always like in my corner. James Tyler over ESPN brought me in to write their work there. And more recently, obviously, you have people like Conan Evans at The Ringer and Chris Ryan. What I would also say is there is a large group of people in football that kind of don't think are relevant, or certainly in my generation, they didn't think what you were saying was relevant until it had a race thing attached. Or they were like, actually, we're already in the fun jobs. We can do those. But you can talk about race. And a key reason I left the UK actually was because I was just fed up of being someone people came to when my expertise was in so many other areas. Because my first two books about football barely mention race. One is about what makes a great footballer. The other one's about what makes a great manager. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you the amount of times I consulted, and those books are both, okay, I'll sound arrogant, those books are both very well reviewed. And the number of times I got asked to write about evaluating player characteristics. This is before the stats era really took off in the UK. So a lot of it was based on the eye test. So in theory, I could have been asked a lot more than I was asked about player characteristics. Why is that important? Why is pressing important? All these things, right? Intensity, fitness levels, vision, all of these things. And I got asked relatively rarely, very rarely, about those aspects of a footballer's makeup. Mm-hmm. It was very, very often when it was race. And I started noticing this. I was like, do you know what, actually, this is so frustrating because I'm going to become a race commentator and all I really want to do is write about football. And yeah, talk about race now and again because it's relevant, but not be like the race guy. Yeah,
it's
and
just,
that's
it's kind just of, like, yeah. Go ahead. No, go for it.
That was happening. My political punditry, it was happening with my football writing, and I was like, you know what? Peace out. I'm done with this.
So Berlin is better?
Yes, actually.
Or is it just removing yourself?
Removing yourself
because then, place.
Yeah, it's a bit of both. I mean, my German's pretty good. I don't write in German, but my German's gonna have to be comfortable there. But removing yourself, and what I realized was also, and I've said this 1,000 times, like being out of that context and going and building a different life, and then all people see of you is your work. Because when you're not in the country, people take you for granted. Mm. So if you're in the UK, I think if you're always three tube stops away, it's easy to drag you into the studio to talk about something nonsensical, something ridiculous. If you're actually harder to get hold of, people have to be like, actually, you know what? Yeah, let me work a bit harder to work out what might fit. So now, like, I have a better life because people are like, actually, I think you'd be good for XYZ project. And I do talk about race. This is the thing. I still write about race now and again, but it's on my terms as opposed to, oh, he's the race guy.
The only time you get an opportunity is when some white dude does something and now I have to come and talk about something I don't even want to talk about.
A lot. And yeah. Here's the thing, don't get me wrong, not everyone in football was like that. Not everyone was like that, but I will say this, it was a lot. It was a lot of people and it was enough for me to be disillusioned with it.
So I have two more questions and then a quick fire round. So here we go. Yeah. How do you handle criticism, both constructive and destructive?
Constructive, very, very well. Destructive, I have no time for it. Constructive criticism, often if someone says me something and it's quite scathing, people can sometimes be quite rude to me on Twitter, but if the person's really smart, I start reading their stuff. Not in a kind of passive aggressive way, but I start reading up about them, like in terms of what they say. No, but like, I start reading. I don't want to, like, because if someone sends you something really rude on Twitter and you start following them back immediately, they might think that's passive aggressive, like you're just trying to keep an eye on them. But what I'll often do is I'll be like, I'll wait a couple of weeks and then start following them on Twitter because of that person taught me something and they came at me in a very angry way, but the substance of what they said was really important. And I need that in my worldview. I need to have that challenge. So I do seek it out. You know, I follow 3,000 accounts, I think, on Twitter, and a lot of them are like people I cannot stand or views that I find abhorrent, but I need to know what the discourse is, right? So I do that. Constructive criticism is pretty good, actually. I've got like, an amazing agent. One time she read a book of mine, and when the book wasn't good enough, she's like, this isn't right. And that was like 120,000 word sci-fi novel. And she's like, no, it's not ready. It's not right. It's not good enough. And I accepted her reasoning on that immediately. So when she rates something of mine, I know it's good. She's got a very good radar. So constructive criticism, I can take it. Destructive criticism, every now and again, most of the time, if I get some abuse, I will mute or block it. I like to mute it because if I mute it, they have to howl into the void.
Function is so good.
It's delicious. But every now and again, if someone comes at me with like a really spiteful comment, for example, some other day said, oh my God, you've got nothing good to say about my club. I politely replied and I said, oh, nothing good about your club. And I sent like three links to things. two articles and one podcast link where I praised the club. And I was like, there you go. All that hate for your club. And everyone saw it and they were like, whoa, that's brutal. I was like, no, like people come at you and call, by all means, come at me for something I've said. Mm. But if I haven't said it, don't put words in my mouth because that goes nowhere good. So that's how I handled it. That's how I handled it. Yeah.
And what does the future look like for you within the next 5 years? Is it more books? Are you diving deeper into podcasting? Are you getting into movies, music? Like what does the next 5 years hold for you, do you think?
More podcasts, more books, more books, more podcasts. I'd love to adapt some of the stuff that I've written for TV. Mm-hmm. I'd love to adapt some, yeah, so whether small screen, big screen, whatever the format is, limited TV series, would love that.
One of them for sure could be
maybe as part of something bigger. I've turned down everything so far. We've been offered stuff, but I've turned down every deal so far for one of them because I don't want to be trapped in the adolescence of, oh, here's the writer's childhood, because that school is well known, that I attended the private school I went to, because it's well known, it's very easy to kind of become here's a TV series of a little boy lost. So I've turned down everything so far on that. But if the right project comes up, I'm open to it.
You just reminded me of something. And it's not a quick fire question, but it's a structural writing question. Mm. And football writing taught me this, where, you know, if you're writing an article about Cristiano Ronaldo, it gets repetitive to say Ronaldo, 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 Ronaldo. So then you find, like, how old is he? Okay, so the 37-year-old, the Portuguese international, you come up with different ways. When you're writing a memoir where you can't necessarily use proper nouns and you have to write he, him, he, him, he, him. Mm. How was that? Like, were you like cringing? Like,
no, it's writing? Easy. It's easy. It's easy. You treat it like dialogue when you're writing a movie. Mm. It's all dialogue. You never get tired of, in dialogue, when you're writing dialogue, you don't get tired of using the name for each thing. So just use it the same. Just be clean and actually don't get scared of repetition. If you look at Grime MCs or you look at the Migos repeat words. Sounds ridiculous. I know Migos repeat words all the time. Yeah. But do you know why they don't care? Because it's the rhythm. Yeah. It's the rhythm that matters. It's not the repetition. If you've got rhythm, you can repeat a word five times in the same paragraph as long as it has rhythm. Then that's the key. So if you establish rhythm, then you're laughing. You can do whatever you like with words.
That's what's up. Okay, and that was just a nerd question.
I love it. No. Always ask the nerd questions, yeah.
So here we go. Quick fire. Are you ready, Musa? 10 questions.
Yeah, go for it.
A country you haven't been to that you would like to?
Chile.
Okay. And if you want to give why, you can give me like a paragraph on why.
Listen, I have my reasons. Listen. Is that intriguing enough for you?
the last good documentary you watched?
Oh, Chernobyl doesn't count as a documentary, does it? The HBO, it doesn't really count as a documentary. Do you know what? Pass. I haven't watched a documentary in a while. I've not watched one for absolutely ages. Okay. It's always been films or series. Yeah.
Then we can go for film and I can lump in question four, which is favorite TV show. So movie, TV show. It doesn't have to be a doc.
Probably The Wire still.
Yeah,
The Wire. The Wire. Currently, it's The Bear. It's The Bear currently. But historically, The Bear? It's The Wire. Oh my God. You're not seeing this. It's about a guy who's basically a guy's brother, his older brother dies, and then he has to take over his restaurant in Chicago, his failing restaurant. And the guy that takes over is like a world-class chef. And he goes home to this tiny like restaurant in Chicago, like, and has to make it the best he can. Yeah, it's amazing.
What does that have to do with bears?
All becomes clear.
Okay. Unironically, next question. If you could be one animal for a day, which animal would you be?
A condor. Oh my God. A condor. There's a condor. They live in the cliffs overlooking the ocean and they fly out to the ocean. They only take the food they need. Condors only take the food they need and they fly out and they basically can stay. They can stay aloft for like ages on just the air vents. So a condor only takes what they need to eat, doesn't eat excess, and they get the best view and they get to mind their own business. It's basically like giving the entire world a mute button because you're up there in the sky. No one can get to you.
See, my answer is like an eagle. So like you get to fly. Yeah. So
they're getting too many fights, they're eagles.
It's only a day. It's only a day. I can be calm for a day.
Listen, a day's a long time. It's a long time.
your favorite skill move, either to observe or to do?
Oh my goodness. Oh.
We're dancing around, Musa.
No, it's a great question. Do you know what? The reason I love the question is because the older I get, the more I love simplicity. I think it's the Iniesta Croqueta, the left-right dribble, the Brian Laudrup. I think it's that one, you know, because you know what it is? It's because it's the one move that actually I look at and I can't work out how it keeps working, but it does. So it must be so devastating in real time that it's impossible. It's basically a crossover, isn't it? It's basically Kevin Durant crossover of like football. Yeah.
You know who's really good at that? Benzema. Who's that? Benzema is amazing at the shift.
He has about three or four things that he's really good at. Actually. He's a weird. He's the closest thing I can think of. He's the closest footballer I've seen to a construction worker. Like, he's really blue collar. He's really weird, Benzema, because he's very elegant technically, but he also doesn't care how it looks. So he wears that, like, you know, that wrist support thing. Like, he's like got an injury, like a permanent. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Benzema's he's an extremely interesting footballer. Yeah. Anyway, carry on. Sorry.
Okay. Your house is on fire. Knock on wood.
Yeah.
You can run in and grab three items of importance to you.
Yes.
Which three things are you grabbing? There's no people or cats inside.
No. I'm already answering it. My dad's passport, my own passport, because my dad died when I was very young. So I keep his passport. It's my most treasured possession of his. Mm. My dad's passport, first of all, then my passport, and then my German ID card. Everything else can burn.
Question number six, and I love this question. The time football made you the most sad?
Oh, like heartbroken on a personal, despondent.
However you feel like defining sadness.
Sad in a superficial level was getting knocked out of the, I think, 1990 World Cup on penalties to West Germany, England.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say the saddest that made me on a human level was there was a guy called Morosini. Morosini played for, I think, Pescara, right? And he was like this amazing, he was meant to be an amazing man. His parents had both died and he was a teenager. And then he was supporting his sister who had like a disability, and his brother had died as well. And then he dropped dead during a football match.
No.
Yeah, and he was beloved. And like, he was so beloved that when... he was so beloved that when he died, like, people that had known him collapsed because like everyone knew him. I think he played for like Italy, like under 21s or something. So like everyone knew him, right? He was like, in those guys, like everyone just knows them, lovely guys. Mm-hmm. And he was so beloved. And then he dies, and it basically, they canceled Serie A or Serie B for like a weekend because everyone
was. This was recently or like 90s?
This is like 2012.
Oh, wow.
And he was like an amazing human. And that made me really, I think that was sad because it was like, it reminded me what a community football is and how these players will know each other. So on a human level, I think it was Morosini actually.
And this is why the next question is to liven the mood a bit. The time football made you the most happy.
Oh my goodness. Without question, the treble. Yeah. 1999, United win the treble. They beat Bayern Munich. The first goal, I was at uni, it was my first, I was the first goal they scored, the equalizer. Everyone hugs everyone. There's like 30 people in a room that's only meant, it's only safe for like 10, but everyone's packed out the room to watch this game on this tiny TV. And when Solskjaer scores the winner, I jumped out of the first floor window at uni and ran around the yard screaming my head off. Yeah, I didn't get back. Yeah, it was the first floor window was basically like, I don't know how many feet off the ground it was. It was maybe 10. Like, 6 to 8, maybe 8 feet, maybe. Yeah, I jumped out the first floor window, but this is a thing, this happened. I ran around the yard. But I had hops back in the day. I had good cushioning, good firm glutes to absorb the blow of the concrete.
There's been no conversation here about basketball, and I apologize. But next time.
Don't worry, all good.
The time football made you the most angry or mad?
Oh my goodness. I laugh about it now, but actually I think it was probably the Suarez handball against Ghana. Because I know why he did it, but at the time I was just like, the rage. Because
We would all do that. Like, but it's just, it had to be him.
It had to be Ghana. Even though Ghana were missing SEM, they still managed to get to that point of the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, and like, you know, there he was just popping up, and he was in his supervillain phase of that. He was like, yeah, he was Suarez.
He bit someone at Ajax, probably.
And then he had stuff.
He was still to do that. Yeah.
He was the last guy. He was the last guy anybody wanted to see popping up on the scene.
That was 2010, and all the other things in the Premier League hadn't happened yet because he bought by Liverpool, what, winter
11? He hadn't done the everything.
I mean, he hadn't even got to the villain. That was just his origin story.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that was the first time he became known to us.
Bro, I was so mad, bro. Hmm. Anyway. That's a good answer. All right, last one, or you know, penultimate one. We are creating Musa Fest. So this is going to be a three-day festival. And I need a headline act for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And you get, dead or alive, you get to bring people back if you want, or they could be alive. So who are the three headliners for Musa Fest?
Oh, my God. Okay. Headliner, first night, Outkast.
Oh, and what? Which era? So, which Outkast are we getting?
Oh, Aquemini Outkast. Oh,
let's go, claps.
Aquemini Outkast first. Yes.
Okay.
Vespertine era, Bjork. Then closer, Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life.
Mm.
Compare David Bowie. Berlin era, David Bowie is the MC throughout.
Throughout. I was gonna say, other than Bowie, we could make that happen.
Quincy Jones is on sound. Sound engineer Quincy Jones. That's how it's got to be. Yeah, absolutely.
So you're going Songs in the Key of Life over like Inner Visions?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Musa. I mean, it's Musa Fest.
I'm going to have guests. Because here's about Stevie, right? It's a bit of a cheat. You know why? Because actually, people respect those artists so much that people will be queuing up to be guests. Guests queuing up.
Oh, for like, sure.
If you had Outkast, you would get Tom York playing piano.
What?
You'd get like Herbie Hancock doing musical director for Outkast, doing a live. If Outkast are doing like Aquemini era Outkast, that means you bring in the whole jazz tradition and you've got like Miles Davis, you've got like Lonnie Liston Smith, you've got like Idris Muhammad on drums, you've got everything. That's what I'm saying. So you actually, the musical director is Herbie Hancock for Outkast, Aquemini. So when we announce the headliners, we announce the credits. We announce each headliner one by one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we announce them like movie credits, like, you know, artistic director is.
So detailed, bro.
That's the level. Those are the levels.
I'm still not over Tom York on piano for Outkast. Like, how did they meet?
That's the thing. It's so sick. Because don't forget, he listened to Doom. He worked with Doom, right? So okay. He had his ear all over the scene. Like Tom York loves hip hop. So
I mean, my answer, or like what my stock answers, it in Rainbow's Radiohead has to be there. So that's whichever day you want to pick. But I love the album. But
see, it's funny because I didn't put Radiohead in there because I thought the Outkast you'd have collabos with Radiohead. you'd bring Tom York on because what a statement to bring Tom York cheating. Into. The, yeah. Oh no no, right. No! Listen, it's my festival.
He's not cheating.
It's my festival. Yeah, exactly. Oh, headliner. As if they can't be Axe on the bill. You see it.
Yeah, intro. I got you. Okay. Last question. Is there anything people should know that's coming or what you got out? Maybe the Stadio podcast. Plug what you will.
I am co-host of the Stadio Football Podcast on Ringer FC with the great Ryan Hun. I'm a frequent guest on Wrighty's House on the Ringer FC with Ian Wright, the great Ian Wright, and the great Carl Anker of this parish. That's what I've got out at the moment. I've got some books out about different things. It depends on what people like, but there's other things. That there's a book called Striking Out, which is a book about, it's a children's book about football, but really it's not about football. It's a bit for Trojan Horse. It's about social financial inequality. It's about how you escape from cycles of domestic emotional abuse and all the rest of it. So that's what it's really about. And then I've got a book about Berlin called In the End It Was All About Love, which I'm very proud of. So yeah, those are the main things I'm working on. The stuff that I'm working on, I can't really talk about because I got to get that out there first. But but yeah.
Yeah. So all the links to Musa will be in the description. All right. So Musa, I thank you for coming on. I think I respected the clock. It's minute past. So we appreciate it. I don't know who we're going to be talking with next time, but we'll be talking with someone. So we thank you and peace out, guys.
Thank you so much. Sports Social Podcast Network.